reading The Phoenix and the Carpet to a speechless group of village children. Like everyone else in the room, she looked uncommonly bright and cheerful. "Funny," Will said as they picked their way through. "Things are absolutely awful, and yet people look much happier than usual. Look at them all, bubbling."
"They are English," Merriman said.
"Quite right," said Will's father. "Splendid in adversity, tedious when safe. Never content, in fact. We're an odd lot." "You're not English, are you?" he said suddenly to Merriman, and Will was astonished to hear a slightly hostile note in his voice.
"A mongrel," Merriman said blandly. "It's a long story."
His deep-set eyes glittered down at Mr. Stanton, and then Miss Greythorne caught sight of them all. "Ah, there you are. Evening, Mr. Stanton. Boys, how are you? What do you think of this, eh? Isn't it a lark?" As she put down the book, the circle of children parted to admit the newcomers, and the twins and their father were absorbed into talk. Merriman said softly to Will in the old speech,
"Look into the fire. For the length of time that it takes you to trace the shape of each of the great signs with your right hand, look into the fire. Make it your friend. Do not move your eyes for all that time."
Wondering, Will moved forward as if to warm himself and did as he was told. Staring at the leaping flames of the enormous log fire in the hearth, he ran his fingers gently over the sign of iron, the sign of bronze, the sign of wood, the sign of stone. He spoke to the fire, not as he had done long ago when challenged to put it out, but as an old one, out of gramarye. He spoke to it of the red fire in the king's hall, of the blue fire dancing over the marshes, of the yellow fire lighted on the Beacon Hills for Beltane and Halloween, of wildfire and needfire and the cold fire of the sea, of the sun and of the stars. The flames leapt. His fingers reached the end of their journey round the last sign. He looked up. He looked, and he saw... He saw not the genial muddle of collected villagers in a tall, panelled modern room lit by electric standard lamps, but the great candle-shadowed stone hall, with its tapestry hangings and high-vaulted roof, that he had seen once before, a world ago. He looked up from the log fire that was the same fire, but blazing now in a different hearth, and he saw as before, out of the past, the two heavy-carved chairs, one on either side of the fireplace. In the chair on the right sat Merriman, cloaked, and in the chair on the left sat a figure whom he had last seen not a day before, lying on a bier as if dead. He bent quickly and knelt at the old lady's feet. "Madam," he said. She touched his hair gently.
"Will, I'm sorry for breaking the circle that first time," he said. "Are you well now?"
"Everything is well," she said in her soft, clear voice,
"and will be if we can win the last battle for the signs."
"What must I do?"
"Break the power of the cold, stop the snow and cold and frost. Release this country from the hold of the dark, all with the next of the circle, the sign of fire."
Will looked at her helplessly.
"But I haven't got it. I don't know how."
"One sign of fire you have with you already. The other waits. In its winning you will break the cold, but before that, our own circle of flame must be completed. That is an echo of the sign, and to do that you must take power away from the dark."
She pointed to the great wrought-iron ring of candle sockets on the table, the circle quartered by a cross. As she raised her arm, the light glinted on the rose ring on her hand. The outer ring of candles was complete, 12 white columns burning exactly as they had when Will was last in the hall. But the cross arm still stood empty-socketed. 9 holes gaped. Will stared at them unhappily. This part of his quest left him in despair. 9 great enchanted candles to come out of nowhere. Power to be seized from the dark. A sign that he had already without knowing it. Another that he must find without knowing where or how.
"Have courage," the old lady said.
Her voice was faint and tired. When Will looked at her, he saw that she herself seemed faint in outline, as if she were no more than a shadow. He reached out his hand in concern, but she drew back her arm.
"Not yet. There is another kind of work to be done yet, too. You see how the candles burn, Will?"
Her voice dwindled, then rallied.
"They will show you."
Will looked at the brilliant candle flames. The tall ring of light held his eyes. As he looked, he felt a strange jolting sensation, as if the whole world had shuddered. He looked up, and he saw... And he saw, when he raised his eyes, that he was back in the manner of Miss Greythorne's time, Will Stanton's time, with the panelled walls and the murmur of many voices, and one voice speaking in his ear. It was Dr. Armstrong.
"Asking for you," he was saying.
Mr. Stanton was standing beside him. The doctor paused and looked oddly at Will. "Are you all right, young man?"
"Yes. Yes, I'm fine. Sorry, what was it you said?"
"I was saying that your old tramp friend is asking for you. The seventh son, he lyrically puts it, though how he knew that, I can't say."
"I am, though, aren't I?" Will said. "I didn't know till the other day about the little brother who died. Tom."
Dr. Armstrong's eyes went a long way away for a moment.
"Tom," he said.
"The first baby.
I remember. That's a while ago."
His gaze came back.
"Yes, you are. So is your father, for that matter."
Will's head jerked round, and he saw his father grin.
"You were a seventh son, Dad."
"Certainly," Roger Stanton said, his round pink face reminiscent. "Half the family was killed in the last war, but there were 12 of us once." "You knew that, didn't you? Proper tribe it was. Your mother loved it, being an only child herself. I dare say that's why she had all you lot. Appalling in this overpopulated age."
"Yes. You're the seventh son of a seventh son. We used to joke about it when you were a baby, but not later on, in case you got ideas about having second sight or whatever it is they say."
"Ha ha,"
said Will with some effort.
"Did you find out what's wrong with the old tramp, Dr. Armstrong?"
"To tell you the truth, he has me rather confused," the doctor said. "He should have a sedative in his disturbed state, but he's got the lowest pulse rate and blood pressure I've ever come across in my life, so I don't know. There's nothing physically wrong with him, so far as I can tell. Probably he's just feeble-minded, like so many of these old wanderers. Not that you see many of them nowadays. They've nearly disappeared. Anyway, he keeps shouting to see you, Will, so if you can put up with it, I'll take you in for a moment. He's harmless enough."
The walker was making a lot of noise. He stopped when he saw Will, and his eyes narrowed. His mood had clearly changed. He was confident again, the lined, triangular face bright. He looked over Will's shoulder at Mr. Stanton and the doctor.
"Go away," he said.
"Hmm," said Dr. Armstrong, but he drew Will's father with him near the door, within sight but out of earshot. In the small cloakroom that was serving as sick bay, one other casualty, the broken leg, lay in bed, but he appeared to be asleep.
"You can't keep me here," the walker hissed. "The rider will come for me."
"You were scared stiff of the rider once," Will said. "I saw you. Have you forgotten that, too?"
"I forget nothing," the walker said scornfully. "That fear is gone. It went when the sign left me. Let me go. Let me get out to my people."
A curious, stiff formality seemed to be coming into his speech.
"Your people didn't mind leaving you to die in the snow," Will said. "Anyway, I'm not keeping you here. I just had you brought to the doctor. You can hardly expect him to let you go out in the middle of a storm."
"Then the rider will come," the old man said.
His eyes glittered and he raised his voice so that he was shrieking to everyone in the room.
"The rider will come! The rider will come!"
Will left him as his father and the doctor came rapidly towards the bed. "What on earth was all that about?" said Mr. Stanton. The walker, with the doctor bending over him, had fallen back and lapsed into angry mumbling again.
"Goodness knows," said Will. "He was just talking nonsense. I think Dr. Armstrong's right. He's a bit cracked."
He looked all round the room, but saw no sign of Merriman. "What's happened to Mr. Lyon?"
"He's somewhere," his father said vaguely.
"Find the twins, would you, Will? I'll go and see if the storm's dropped enough to let us out yet." Will stood in the bustling hall as people came and went with blankets and pillows, cups of tea, sandwiches from the kitchen, empty plates, going back again. He felt odd, detached, as though he were suspended in the middle of this preoccupied world and yet not part of it. He looked at the great hearth. Even the roar of the flames could not drown out the howling wind outside, and the lash of icy snow against the window panes. The flames leapt, holding Will's eyes. From somewhere outside time, Merriman said into his mind,
"Take care. It is true. The rider will come for him. That is why I had you bring him here to a place strengthened by time. The rider would have come to your own house otherwise. And all that comes with the rider, too."
"Will?" Miss Greythorne's imperious contralto came ringing. "Come over here." And Will looked back into the present and went to her. He saw Robin beside her chair and Paul approaching with a long flat box of a familiar shape in his hands.
"We thought we'd have a kind of concert until the wind drops," said Miss Greythorne briskly. "Everyone doing a little bit, everyone who fancies the idea, that is. A keely, or whatever the Scots call them."
Will looked at the happy gleam in his brother's eye. "And Paul's going to play that old flute of yours that he likes so much."
"In due course," Paul said.
"And you're going to sing."
"All right."
Will looked at Robin.
"I," said Robin, "am going to lead the applause. There'll be a lot of that. We appear to be a madly talented village. Miss Bell will recite a poem. 3 boys from the Dorney End have a folk group. 2 of them even brought their guitars. Old Mr. Dewhurst will do a monologue, just try and stop him. Somebody's little daughter wants to dance. There's no end to it."
"I thought, Will," said Miss Greythorne, "that perhaps you would begin. If you were just to start singing, you know, anything you like, then gradually people would stop to listen and there'd be a complete hush. Much better than me ringing a bell or something and saying, 'We will all now have a concert.' Don't you agree?"
"I suppose so, yes," said Will, though nothing could have been further from his mind at that moment than the idea of making peaceful music. He thought briefly, and into his mind came a melancholy little song that the school music master had transposed for his voice just the term before, as an experiment. Feeling rather a show-off, Will opened his mouth where he stood and began to sing. "White in the moon the long road lies, the moon stands blank above. White in the moon the long road lies that leads me from my love. Still hangs the edge without a gust, still, still the shadows stay. My feet upon the moonlit dust pursue the ceaseless way." The talking around him fell away into silence. He saw faces turned in his direction, and nearly dropped a note as he recognized some that he had hoped to see, but had not found before. There they were, keeping quietly in the background. Farmer Dawson, old George, John Smith and his wife. The old ones, ready again to make their circle, if need be. Nearby was the rest of the Dawson family, Will's father standing with them. "The world is round, so travellers tell, and straight though reach the track. Trudge on, 'twill all be well. The way will guide one back." From the corner of one eye he saw with a shock the figure of the walker, with a blanket wrapped round him like a cloak. The old man was standing in the doorway of the little sick room, listening. For an instant Will saw his face and was astonished. All guile and terror were gone from that lined triangle. There was only sadness on it, and hopeless longing. There was even a glint of tears in the eyes. It was the face of a man shown something immensely precious that he had lost. For a second, Will felt that with his music he could draw the walker into the light. He gazed at him as he sang, making the plaintive notes an appeal, and the walker stood limp and unhappy, looking back. "But ere the circle homeward hies, far, far must it remove. White in the moon the long road lies, that leads me from my love." The room had stilled dramatically as he sang, and the boy's clear soprano that always seemed to belong to a stranger soared high and remote through the air. Now there was a small silence, the only part of performing that really meant anything to him, and afterwards quite a lot of clapping. Will heard it from a long way away. Miss Greythorne called to them all.
"We thought, to pass the time, that anyone who feels inclined might do a little entertaining, to drown out the storm. Who'd like to join in?"
There was a cheerful buzz of voices, and Paul began to play the old manor flute, very soft and low. Its gentle sweetness filled the room, and Will stood more confidently as he listened and thought of the light. But in the next moment the music could no longer bring him strength. He could not hear it at all. His hair prickled, his bones ached. He knew that something, somebody, was coming near, wishing ill to the manor and all inside it, and most of all himself. The wind rose. It whipped screeching at the window. There was a tremendous thump of a knock at the door. Across the room the walker jumped up, his face twisted again, tight with waiting. Paul played, unhearing. The crashing knock came again. None of them could hear, Will realized suddenly. Though the wind was near to deafening him, it was not for their ears, nor would they know what was happening now. The crash came a third time, and he knew that he was bound to answer. He walked along through unheeding people to the door, took hold of the big iron circle that was the handle, muttered some words under his breath in the old speech, and flung open the door. Snow spat in at him, sleet slashed his face, winds whistled through the hall. Out in the darkness the great black horse reared up high over Will's head, hooves flailing, eyes rolling white, the foam flying from bared teeth. And above it gleamed the blue eyes of the rider and the flaring red of his hair. In spite of himself, Will cried out, and threw up one arm instinctively in self-defense. And the black stallion screamed and fell back with the rider into the dark. And the door swung shut, and there was all at once nothing in Will's ears except the sweet lilt of the old flute as Paul played on. People sat and sprawled tranquilly about just as they had before. Slowly, Will brought down his arm, still crooked defensively up over his head. And as he did so, he noticed something that he had totally forgotten. On the underside of the forearm, which had been facing the black rider when he threw up his arm, was the burned-in scar of the sign of iron. In that other great hall, the first time, he had burned himself on the sign when the dark was making its first attempt on him. The lady had healed the burn. Will had forgotten it was there. "One sign of fire you have with you already." So that was what she had meant. One sign of fire had kept the dark at bay, driven it out of its strongest attack, perhaps. Will leaned limply against the wall and tried to breathe more slowly. But as he looked across the tranquil crowd listening to their music, he saw again a figure that sent all his confidence crashing into nothing. And the quick instinct of Grammary told him that he had been tricked. He had thought he was out facing a challenge, and so he was. But in doing it, he had opened the door between the dark and the walker, and thus in some way so strengthened the walker that the old man had gained a power he had been waiting for. For the walker was standing tall now, his eyes bright, his head flung up and his back straight. He held one arm high and called out in a strong, clear voice, "Come, wolf! Come, hound! Come, cat! Come, rat! Come, held! Come, holder! I call you in! Come, Ura! Come, Tan! Come, Col! Come, Quirt! Come, Modder! Come, master! I bring you in!" The summons went on, a long list of names, all familiar to Will from the Book of Grammary. In Miss Greythorne's hall no one could see or hear. All went on as before, and through the ending of Paul's music and the loud, determined beginning of old Mr. Dewhurst's monologue, no eyes that glanced in Will's direction seemed to see him. He wondered whether his father, still standing talking to the Dawsons, would shortly notice that his youngest son was not to be seen. But very soon, as the ringing summons from the walker went on, he ceased to wonder, for under his senses the hall began subtly to change. The old hall of the lady came back into his consciousness and absorbed more and more of the appearance of the present. Friends and family faded, Only the walker remained, clear as before, standing now at the far end of the great hall, away from the fire. And while Will still stared at the group in which his father stood, even while it faded, he saw take place the doubling by which the old ones were able to move themselves in and out of time. He saw one form of Frank Dawson step easily out of the first, leaving his other self to fade as part of the present. The second form grew clearer and clearer as it came towards him, and after it in the same way came old George, young John, and the blue-eyed woman, and Will knew this had been the manner of his own arrival too. Soon the four were grouped round him in the centre of the ladies' hall, each facing outward, four corners of a square. And as the walker called his long summons of the dark, the hall itself began again to change. Strange lights and flames flickered along the walls, obscuring the windows and hangings. Here and there, at the sound of a particular name, blue fire would dart up into the air, hiss, and die down again. On each of the three walls facing the hearth, three great sinister flames shot up, which did not afterwards die down, but remained dancing and curving in ominous brilliance, filling the hall with cold light. Before the hearth, in the big carved chair he had occupied from the beginning, Merriman sat motionless. There was a terrible restrained strength in his sitting. Will looked at the broad shoulders with foreboding, as he would have looked at a gigantic spring that might at any moment snap loose. The walker chanted louder, "Come Uath, come Truith, come Eriu, come Loth, come Huergo, come Kelmis, I bring you in." Merriman stood up, a great black-white plumed pillar. His cloak was wrapped round him. Only his carved stone face was clear with the light blazing in his mass of white hair. The walker looked at him and faltered. Thick round the hall, the fires and flames of the dark hissed and danced, all white and blue and black, with no gold or red or warm yellow in any. The nine tallest flames stood up like menacing trees. But the walker seemed to have lost his voice again. He looked once more at Merriman and shrank back a little. And through the mixture of longing and fear in the bright eyes, suddenly Will knew him.
"Hawkins," Merriman said softly. "There is still time to come home."
The Hawk in the Dark. The walker said in a whisper,
"No." "Hawkin,"
Merriman said again gently,
"every man has a last choice after the first. A chance of forgiveness. It is not too late. Turn. Come to the light."
The voice was scarcely audible, a mere husking breath.
"No."
The flames hung still and stately round the great hall. No one moved.
"Hawkin,"
Merriman said, and there was no command in the tone, but only warmth and entreaty.
"Hawkin, liege man, turn away from the dark. Try to remember. There was love and trust between us, once."
The walker stared at him like a doomed man, and now in the pointed, lined face, Will could see clearly the traces of the small, bright man, Hawkin, who had been brought forward out of his time for the retrieving of the Book of Grammary, and had, through the shock of facing death, betrayed the old ones to the dark. He remembered the pain that had been in Merriman's eyes as they watched that betrayal begin, and the terrible certainty with which he had contemplated Hawkins' doom. The walker still stared at Merriman, but his eyes did not see. They looked back through time as the old man rediscovered all that he had forgotten or pushed out of his mind. He said slowly, with mounting reproach,
"You made me risk my life for a book. For a book. And because I looked at kinder masters, you sent me back to my own time, but not as I have been before. You gave me, then, the doom of bearing the sign."
His voice grew stronger with pain and resentment as he remembered. The sign of bronze. Through the centuries, you change me from a man into a creature always running, always searching, always hunted. You stop me from growing decently old in my own time, as all men after their lives grow old and tired and sink to sleep in death. You took away my right to death. You set me in my own century with the sign long, long ago, and you made me carry it through 600 years until this age. His eyes flickered towards Will and flashed with hatred. Until the last of the old ones should be born to take the sign from me. You, boy, it is all through you. This turning in time that took away my good life as a man, it was all on your account. Before you were born, and after, for your damned gift of gramarye, I lost everything I had ever loved. I tell you, Merriman cried out, you may come home, Hawkin. Now. It is the last chance, and you may turn to the light and be as you were. His proud, towering figure leaned forward, beseeching, and Will felt pain for him, knowing that he felt it was his own misjudgment that had brought his servant Hawkin into betrayal and the life of the wretched Walker, a whining shell committed to the dark. Merriman said huskily, I pray you, my son. No, the Walker said. I found better masters than you. The 9 flames of the dark round the wall sprang cold and high and burned with a blue light quivering. He clutched closer at the dark blanket wrapped round him and stared wildly about the hall. Shrilly defiant, he shouted, Masters of the dark, I bring you in! And the 9 flames moved in closer from the walls to the center of the room, approaching Will and the 4 outward-facing old ones. Will was blinded by their blue-white brilliance. He could no longer see the Walker. Somewhere beyond the great lights, the shrill voice shrieked on, high and mad with bitterness. You risked my life for the book. You made me carry the sign. You let the dark hound me through the centuries, but never let me die. Now it is your turn! Your turn! Your turn! Echoed the scream round the walls. The 9 tall flames moved slowly closer, and the old ones stood in the center of the floor and watched them approach. Beside the hearth, Merriman turned slowly towards the center of the room. Will saw that his face was impassive again, the deep eyes dark and empty and the lines drawn firm, and he knew that no one would see any strong self-revealing emotion on that face for a very long time. The Walker's chance to turn back to the mind and heart of Hawkin had come and been rejected, and now it was gone forever. Merriman raised both his arms, and the cloak fell from them like wings. His deep voice whipped into the crackling silence. Stop! The 9 flames paused and hung. In the name of the Circle of Signs, Merriman said, clear and firm, I command you to leave this house. The cold light of the dark that was all around the hall behind the great standing flames flickered and crackled like laughter. And out of the blackness beyond, the voice of the Black Rider came. Your circle is not complete and has not that force. He called mockingly, and your liege man has called us into this house as he did before, and can again. Our liege man, my lord. The hawk is in the dark. You can drive us from here no longer, not with flame, nor force, nor conjoined power. We shall break your sign of fire before it can be released. And your circle will never be joined. It will break in the cold, my lord, in the dark and the cold. Will shivered. It was growing cold indeed in the hall. Very cold. The air was like a current of chill water coming at them from all sides. The fire in the great hearth gave out no warmth now, no warmth that was not sucked in by the cold blue flames of the dark all around. The nine flames quivered again, and as he looked at them, he could have sworn that they were not flames, but gigantic icicles, blue-white as before, but solid, menacing, great pillars, ready to topple inward and crush them all with weight and cold.
"Cold," said the Black Rider softly from the shadows. "Cold."
Will looked at Merriman in alarm. He knew that each of them, every old one in the room, had been thrusting against the dark with every power he possessed since the rider's voice began, and he knew that none of it had had any effect. Merriman said softly,
"Hawkin lets them in as he did in his first betrayal, and we cannot prevent that. He had my trust once, and it gives him still that power, even though the trust is gone. Our only hope is what it was in the beginning, that Hawkin is no more than a man. When the spells of the deep cold are made, there is little that can be done against them."
He stood frowning as the ring of blue-white fire flickered and danced. Even he looked cold, with a dark, pinched look round the bones of his face.
"They bring in the deep cold," he said, half to himself, "the cold of the void, of black space."
And the cold grew more and more intense, cutting through the body to the mind. Yet the flames of the dark seemed at the same time to grow dim, and Will realized that his own sentry was again fading in around them, and that they were back in Miss Greythorn's manor. And the cold was there, too. Everything was changing now. The murmur of voices had dropped from a cheerful buzz to an anxious mutter, and the tall room was only dimly lit by candles set in candlesticks and cups and plates wherever there was space. All the bright electric lamps were dark, and the long metal radiators that warmed most of the room gave off no heat. Merriman swooped bafflingly up near him with the speed of one returned from a brisk errand. His cloak was subtly different, changed to the sweeping overcoat he had worn earlier that day. He said to Miss Greythorn,
"There's not much we can do down there, ma'am. The furnace is out, of course. All the electric power lines are quite dead. So is the telephone. I have had all the house blankets and quilts brought out, and Miss Hampton is making quantities of soup and hot drinks."
Miss Greythorn nodded in brisk approval.
"Good thing we kept the old gas stoves. They wanted me to change an O-line when we had the central heating done. I wouldn't, though. Electricity, bah! I always knew the old house didn't approve."
"I'm having as much wood as possible brought in to keep the fire up," Merriman said, but in the same instant, as if in mockery, a great hissing and steaming came from the broad fireplace, and those nearest it jerked away, choking and spluttering. Through the sudden, inblown cloud of smoke, Will could see Frank Dawson and old George working to clear something out of the fire, but the fire had gone out.
"Snow down the chimney," Farmer Dawson called, coughing. "We'll need buckets, Merry, quickly. There's a right mess here."
"I'll go,"
Will shouted and bolted for the kitchen, glad of the chance to move. But before he could get to the door, through the huddled groups of chilled, frightened people, a figure rose up before him to block his way, and two hands caught his arms in a grip so tight that he gasped in sudden pain. Bright eyes bored into his, glittering with wild triumph, and the walker's high, thin voice was screeching in his ear.
Old one, last of the old ones, you know what's going to happen to you. The cold is coming in and the dark will freeze you. Cold and stiff and all of you helpless. No one to protect the little signs on your belt. Let go!"
Will twisted angrily, but the old man's hold on his wrist was the clasp of madness.
"And you know who will take the little signs, old one? I shall. The poor walker, I shall wear them. They are promised to me in reward for my services. No lords of the light ever offer me such reward, or any other. I shall be the sign-seeker, I shall. And all that would have been yours at the last shall come to me."
He grabbed for Will's belt, his face twisted with triumph, spittle wringing his mouth like foam, and Will yelled for help. In an instant, John Smith was at his side, with Dr. Armstrong close behind, and the big Smith had pinned the walker's clutching hands behind his back. The old man cursed and shrieked, his eyes burning with hatred at Will, and both men had to struggle to hold him back. At length, they had him trapped and harmless, and Dr. Armstrong drew back with an exasperated sigh.
"This chap must be the only warm object in the country," he said. Of all times to run berserk, pulse or no pulse, I'm going to put him to sleep for a while. He's a danger to the community and to himself. Will thought, rubbing his sore wrist. If you only knew quite what sort of danger he is. Then suddenly he began to see what Merriman had meant. Our only hope is what it was in the beginning. That Hawkin is no more than a man. Keep him there, John, while I get my bag. The doctor disappeared. John Smith, one big fist grasping the walker's shoulder and the other both his wrists, winked encouragingly at Will and jerked his head to the kitchen. Will suddenly remembered his original errand and ran. When he came tearing back with two empty buckets swinging from each hand, there was a fresh commotion at the fireplace. A new hissing had begun, smoke spewed out, and Frank Dawson came staggering backwards. "Hopeless," he said furiously. "Hopeless. You get the hearth clear for a moment and more snow comes pouring down. And the cold." He looked despairingly about him. "Look at them, Will." The room was misery and chaos. Small babies wailing. Parents huddling their bodies round their children to keep them warm enough to breathe. Will rubbed his chill hands together and tried to feel his feet and his face through the numbness of cold. The room was becoming colder and colder, and from the freezing world outside there was no sound even of the wind. The sense of being within two levels of time at once still hovered in his mind, though all that he could feel now of the ancient manor was the awareness, ominous and persistent, of the nine great ice candles glimmering round three sides of the room. They had been ghost-like, scarcely visible when first he found himself brought back by the new cold to his own time. But as the cold grew more intense, so they were growing clearer. Will stared at them. He knew that somehow they embodied the power of the dark at its midwinter peak. Yet he knew, too, that they were part of an independent magic, harnessed by the dark, which, like so much else in their long battle, could be taken away by the light if only the right thing were done at the right time. How? How? Dr. Armstrong was coming back towards the sick room with his black bag. Perhaps there might, after all, be one way, just one, of stopping the dark before the cold could reach the point of destruction. One man, unwitting, giving help to another. This might be the one small event to turn aside all the supernatural force of the dark. Will waited, suddenly taut with excitement. The doctor moved towards the walker, who still cursed incoherently in John the Smith's grip, and he had slipped a needle deftly in and out of his arm before the old man knew what he was doing. "There," he said soothingly, "that'll help you. Have a sleep." Instinctively, Will moved forward in case there was need of help, and saw as he did so that Merriman and Farmer Dawson and old George were drifting closer too. Doctor and patient were closed in by a ring of old ones, all round, protecting against interference. The walker caught sight of Will and snarled like a dog showing broken, yellowing teeth.
"Freeze! You'll freeze," he spat out at him, "and the signs will be mine. Whatever you try, whatever."
But he faltered and blinked, his voice dropping as the drug began to spread its drowsiness over him. And even as suspicion began to show in his eyes, the eyelids drooped. Each of the old ones took a step or two forward, tightening the circle. The old man blinked again, showing the whites of his eyes in a horrid flash. And then he was unconscious. And with the mind of the walker closed, the dark's way into the house was closed too. Instantly there was a difference in the room, a slackening of tension. The cold was less fierce. The unhappiness and alarm all round them, like a fog, began to lessen. Dr. Armstrong straightened up, a questing, puzzled expression in his eyes. The eyes grew wider as he saw the circle of intent faces ringing him round. He began indignantly, "What do you—" But the rest of the words were lost to Will, for all at once Merriman was calling them out of the crowd, urgently, silently, in the speech of the mind that men could not hear.
The candles of the winter, take them before they fade."
The four old ones scattered hastily into the hall, where the strange blue-white cylinders still hung ghostly round the three walls, burning with their dead cold flames. Going swiftly to the candles, they grasped them, one in each hand. Will, smaller, leapt hastily on a chair to seize the last. It was cold and smooth and heavy to his touch, like ice that did not melt. In the moment that he touched it, he was giddy. His head whirled. And he was back in the great hall of that earlier time, with the other four. And beside the hearth, the lady was sitting in her high-backed chair again, with the smith's blue-eyed wife sitting at her feet. It was clear what was to be done. Bearing the candles of the dark, they advanced towards the great iron mandala ring of holders on the massive table, and one by one fitted the candles into the nine sockets that still stood empty in the central crosspiece. Each candle changed subtly as it was put in place. Its flame rose thinner and higher, taking on a golden white tinge instead of the cold, threatening blue. Will, with his one candle, came last. He reached through to fit it into the last holder in the very centre of the pattern, and as he did so, the flames of all the candles shot upwards in a triumphant circle of fire. The old lady said in her frail voice,
"There is the power seized from the dark, Will Stanton. By cold magic they called up the candles of winter for destruction. But now that we have seized them for better purposes, the candles become stronger, able to bring you the sign of fire. See."
They drew back, watching, and the last central candle that Will had put in place began to grow. When its flame stood high above the rest, it took on colour, becoming yellow, orange, vermilion red. As it still grew, it changed and became a strange flower on a strange stem. A curved, many-petaled blossom blazed there, each petal a different shade of the colours of flame. Slowly and gracefully, each petal opened and fell, floating away, melting into the air. And in the end, at the tip of the long curved stem of the flame-red plant, a glowing round seed pod was left, waving gently for a moment, and then in a quick, silent burst, breaking open, its five sides unfolding all at once like stiffer petals. Inside was a golden-red circle of a shape they all knew. The lady said,
"Take it, Will."
Will took two wandering paces towards the table, and the great slender stalk bent over towards him. As he put out his hand, the golden circle fell into it. Instantly, a surge of invisible power struck him, an echo of what he had felt at the destruction of the Book of Grammary. And as he staggered and balanced himself again, he saw that the table was empty. In a flash of time, everything that was on it had vanished. The strange flower and the nine great blazing candles and the sign-shaped iron holder that had contained them all. Gone. All gone. All except the sign of fire. It was in his palm, warm to the touch. One of the most beautiful things he had ever seen. Gold of several different colours had been beaten together with great craftsmanship to make its crossed circle shape, and on all sides it was set with tiny gems, rubies and emeralds and sapphires and diamonds, in strange runic patterns that looked oddly familiar to Will. It glittered and gleamed in his hand like all kinds of fire that ever were. Looking closer, he saw some words written very small around the outer edge. "Licht mech het gewirkan." Merriman said softly, "The light ordered that I should be made." They had all but one of the signs now. Jubilantly, Will flung up his arm into the air, holding the sign high for the others to see, and from every light in the hall the circle of worked gold caught brilliance, flickering as if it were made of flame. From somewhere outside the hall, there came a great crashing roar with a long wail of anger through it. The sound rumbled and growled and came crashing out again. And as it beat in his ears, Suddenly, Will was back again in Miss Greythorne's hall, with all around him the familiar village faces turned wondering to the roof and to the grumbling roar beyond. "Thunder?" someone said, puzzled. Blue light flickered in all the windows, and the thunder slammed so ear-splittingly close that everyone flinched. Again the light came, again the thudding roar, and somewhere a child began to weep thin and high. But as all the crowded room waited for the next crash, there was nothing. No flash came, no thunder, not so much as a distant murmur. Instead, after a short, breathless silence, filled only by the hissing of the ashes in the hearth, there came a soft, pattering sound outside, growing gently, gradually louder, into an unmistakable slurred staccato against windows and doors and roof. The same anonymous voice cried out joyfully, "Rain!" Voices broke out all round in excitement, grim faces beamed, figures rushed to peer out of the dark windows, beckoning to others in delight. An old man Will never recalled seeing in his life before turned to him with a toothless grin. "Rain or melt thick snow," he piped. "Meltin' in no time at all." Robin appeared out of the crowd. "Ah, there you are. Am I going loopy, or does this perishing room suddenly feel warm?" "It's warmer," said Will, pulling down his sweater. Beneath it, the sign of fire was now looped on his belt, secure with the rest. "Funny. It was so hideously cold for a while. I suppose they've got the central heating going again. Let's see the rain." A pair of boys dashed past them to the main door. But while they still fumbled with the handle, a series of quick, loud knocks came from outside. And there on the step, when the door opened, his hair flattened to his head by the soft, pouring rain, stood Max. He was out of breath. They could see him urgently gulp air to make the words.
"Miss Greythorne there. My father."
Will felt a hand on his shoulder and saw Merriman beside him, and knew from the concern in his eyes that in some way this was the next attack of the dark. Max caught sight of him and came forward, rain running down his face. He shook himself like a dog.
"Get Dad, Will," he said. "And the doctor, if he can be spared. Mum's had an accident. She fell downstairs. She's still unconscious, and we think she's got a broken leg."
Mr. Stanton had already heard. He dashed for the doctor's room. Will stared unhappily at Max. He called silently to Merriman, frightened.
"Did they do that? Did they? The lady said..."
"It's possible," said the answering voice in his mind. "They cannot harm you, true. And they cannot destroy men. But they can encourage men's own instincts to do them harm, or bring an unexpected clap of thunder when someone is standing at the top of a flight of stairs." Will heard no more than that. He was out of the door with his father and brothers and Dr. Armstrong, following Max home.
The King of Fire and Water. James still looked pale and distressed, even when the doctor was safely arrived and examining Mrs. Stanton in the living room. He drew aside his nearest brothers, who happened to be Paul and Will, and moved them out of earshot of the rest. He said unhappily,
"Mary's disappeared."
"Disappeared? Honestly? I told her not to go. I didn't think she would. I thought she'd be too scared."
Worry had sent stoical James close to tears.
"Go where?" said Paul sharply. "Out to the manor. It was after Max went to get you. Gwenny and Barb were in the living room with Mum. Mary and I were in the kitchen making some tea, and she got all upset and said Max had been gone far too long and we ought to go and check whether anything had happened to him. I told her not to be so daft. Of course we shouldn't go, but just then Gwen called me to go and make up the fire in there, and when I came back, Mary was gone, and so were her coat and boots."
He sniffed.
"I couldn't see any sign of where she'd gone. Outside, the rain had started, and there weren't any footprints. I was just going to go out after her without saying anything, because the girls had enough to worry about. But then you came, and I thought she'd be with you. Only she wasn't." "Oh, dear," said James woefully. "She is a silly ass."
"Never mind,"
Paul said. She can't have gone far. Just go and wait for a good moment to explain to Dad, and tell him I've gone out to pick her up. I'll take Will. We're both still dressed for it.
Good, said Will, who had hastily been trying to think of arguments for his going. When they were out in the rain again, the snow already beginning to squelch grey-white underfoot, Paul said, Don't you think it's time you told me what all this is about?
What? Said Will, astounded.
What are you mixed up in? Paul said, his pale blue eyes peering severely through the heavy spectacles.
Nothing.
Look, if Mary's going off might have something to do with it, you've absolutely got to explain.
Oh, dear, Will said.
He looked at Paul's threatening determination, and wondered how you explained to an elder brother that an 11-year-old was no longer quite an 11-year-old, but a creature subtly different from the human race, fighting for its survival. You didn't, of course.
He said, It's these, I think.
Glancing cautiously about him, he tugged his jacket and sweater clear of his belt and showed Paul the signs.
They're antiques. Just buckle things that Mr. Dawson gave me for my birthday. But they must be really valuable, because two or three weird people keep on turning up trying to get hold of them. One man chased me in Huntercombe Lane once, and that old tramp was mixed up with them somehow. That was why I didn't want to bring him home. That day we found him in the snow.
He thought how very improbable it all sounded. Paul said. And that fellow at the manor? The new butler?
Lion, isn't it?
Is he mixed up with these clowns?
Oh, no, Will said hastily. He's a friend of mine.
Paul looked at him for a moment, expressionless. Will thought of his patient understanding that night in the attic, at the beginning, and of the way he played the old flute, and knew that if there were any one of his brothers that he could confide in, it would be Paul. But that was out of the question. Paul said, Obviously you haven't told me the half of it, but that'll have to do. I take it you think these antique chasers might have nobbled Mary as some sort of hostage? They had reached the end of the driveway. The rain beat down on them hard, yet not vicious. It ran down the snowbanks, poured from the trees, turned the road into the beginning of a rapidly moving stream. They looked up and down in vain.
Will said, They must have. I mean, she'd have gone straight towards the manor, so why didn't we see her on our way home?
We'll go that way anyway, to check. Paul tilted his head suddenly and glared at the sky.
This rain, it's ridiculous. Just suddenly, out of all that snow. And it's so much warmer, too. Makes no sense.
He splashed off up the running stream that was Huntercombe Lane, and glanced at Will with a baffled half-grin. But then a lot of things aren't making much sense to me at the moment.
Ah, Will said. No.
He splashed away noisily to cover his remorse and peered through the sheets of rain for some sign of his sister. The noise around them was astonishing now, an ocean noise of spattering foam and washing shingle and breaking waves, as the wind brought the rain sluicing rhythmically through the trees. A most ancient noise, as if they stood on the edge of some great ocean before men or their ancestors were ever born. Up the road they went, peering and doggedly calling, anxious now. Everything they saw became strange all over again, as the rain carved the snow into new lanes and hillocks. But when they came to one corner, Will knew suddenly very well where they were. He saw Paul duck defensively behind one raised arm, heard the harsh, raucous croaking abruptly loud, and then gone, saw, even through the flying rain, the flurry of black feathers as the gaggle of rooks swooped low past their heads. Paul straightened slowly, staring.
What on earth?
Get over the other side of the road, Will said, pushing him firmly sideways.
The rooks go sort of crazy sometimes. I've seen it before.
Another shrieking swoop of birds came at Paul from behind, driving him forward, while the first dived again to force Will against the snowbank along the edge of the drift-buried wood. Again they came, and again. Will wondered, dodging, whether his brother had realized that they were being herded like sheep, driven where the rooks wanted them to go. But even as he wondered, he knew that he was too late. The grey sheet of rain had separated them entirely. He had no idea where Paul had gone. He yelled in panic, Paul! Paul! But as the old one in him took control, calming the fear, he cut off the shout. This was not a matter for ordinary human beings, even of his own family. He should be glad to be alone. He knew now that Mary must be caught somewhere, held by the dark. Only he had any chance of getting her back. He stood in the driving rain, staring about him. The light was dying rapidly. Will unbuckled his belt and strapped it round his right wrist. Then he said a word in the old speech and held up his arm. And from the signs a steady pathway of light beamed out as from a torch. It shone on ruffled brown water where the road was becoming a river, deeper and flowing fast. He remembered that Merriman had said, long before, that the most dangerous peak of the dark's power would come at Twelfth Night. Was that time now come? He had lost his place in the days. They ran into one another in his mind. Water washed at the edge of his boot as he stood, wondering. He jumped hastily backwards to the snowbank edging the wood, and a brown wave in the road river took a large bite out of the snow wall on which he had been standing. In the light from the signs, Will saw that now other chunks of dirty snow and ice bobbed in the water. As it flowed past, it was gradually undercutting the hard-packed banks left on either side by the snowplough and carrying away broken pieces like miniature icebergs. Other things were there in the water, too. He saw a bucket bob past him, and a tufted object that looked like a sack of hay. The water must be rising high enough to carry things away from people's gardens, perhaps his own among them. How could it rise so fast? As if in answer, the rain hammered at his back, and more snow broke beneath his foot, and he remembered that the ground underneath him must still be frozen bone-hard by the great cold that had paralyzed the land before the rain came. Nowhere would this rain be able to soak into the soil. The thawing of the land would take far longer than the melting of the snow, and in the meantime the snow water had nowhere to go, no alternative but to run over the surface of the frozen countryside looking for a river to join. The floods will be dreadful, Will thought. Worse than they'd ever been before. Worse, even, than the cold. But a voice broke in on him. A shout through the rushing water and roaring rain. He stumbled up over the slush-edged mounds of snow to peer through the murk. The shout came again.
Will! Over here!
Paul?
Will called hopefully, but he knew it was not Paul's voice.
Here! Over here!
The shout came from the river road itself, out in the dark. Will held up the signs. Their light beamed out over the churning water and showed him what he took at first for clouds of steam. Then he saw that the curling steam was the puffing of breath. Great deep breaths from a gigantic horse standing four square in the water. Small wild waves foaming past its knees. Will saw the broad head, the long chestnut mane plastered wet to the neck. And he knew that this was either Castor or Pollux, one of the two great shire horses from Dawson's farm. The light from the signs flicked higher. He saw old George, muffled in black oilskins, perched high on the back of the massive horse.
"Over here, Will! Through the water, before it rises too fast! We have work to do, come on!"
He had never heard old George sound demanding before. This was the old one, not the amiable old farmhand. Leaning against the horse's neck, the old man urged it closer through the water.
"Come up, Polly! Come by, Sir Pollux!"
And big Pollux snorted puffs of steam through his broad nostrils and took a few solid paces forward so that Will was able to stumble out into the river road and grasp at his tree-like leg. The water came almost to his thighs, but he was so wet from the rain already that it made little difference. There was no saddle on the great horse, only a sodden blanket. But with astonishing strength, old George leaned down and heaved at his hand, and with much struggling, he was up. The light from the signs, strapped to his wrist, did not waver through all the turning and twisting, but remained directed firmly forwards at the way they should go. Will slipped and slithered on the broad back, too wide for his straddling. George tugged him to sit in front, astride the great curving neck.
"Polly's shoulders have taken greater weight than you!"
he shouted in Will's ear. Then they were swaying forward as the stolid cart-horse lurched off again, splashing through the growing stream, away from the Rookswood, away from the Stanton's house.
"Where are we going?"
Will yelled, staring fearfully out at the darkness. He could see nothing anywhere, only the swirling water in the light of the signs.
"We go to raise the hunt,"
the cracked old voice said close to his ear.
"The hunt? What hunt?" George, I must find Mary. They've got Mary somewhere, and I lost sight of Paul.
We go to raise the hunt,
the voice at his back said steadily.
I have seen Paul. He is safe on his way home by now. Mary you will find in due course. It is time for the hunt.